I'd like to bring to order the Higher Education Policy and Finance Committee. We do have a quorum, and the first order of business would be the minutes from February the 25th. Do we have a motion? Representative Barrett moves the approval of the minutes. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? Minutes approved. We have two bills up today, members, and this time I'd like to bring House File 742 before the committee. Do I have a motion to bring it forward to our committee? Representative?
I'd like to make that motion, Chair. Thank you.
The motion would be to bring it from this committee to the Public Safety and Crime Prevention Policy and Finance Committee.
Yes, that would be the motion.
Yeah. Okay. Do you would like to begin, Representative O'Neill, and explain your bill?
Thank you, Chair. I actually have an author's amendment as well that I would like to offer so that we can put the bill in the shape I would like it.
Okay, that's the DE3?
Yes.
Amendment? Okay.
The DE3. I'd like to move the DE3 so that we can have the bill in the shape that I would like it.
Okay. You want to discuss what the amendment does?
I would actually like to just put it together,
put it
because
together?
It's
all
very
right.
Complex, and then we can talk about the bill as a whole.
Okay. All right, and we'll vote. All those in favor of the DE3 amendment, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Okay, the amendment is approved. Now you may begin.
Thank you, Chair. And actually, I'd like to bring up my testifiers from the University of Minnesota. And I'm honored to have worked with many, many parties on this particular bill. And today I have with us some students from the U of M, and we have our student body president, Joelle, that's here. And I'm going to just briefly tell you about the bill, and then I'd love to turn it over to testimony from them. And then after that, I've got Mincasa that will be coming up. I'm honored to bring forth this bill to you today, and it's a bipartisan bill. My first co-author is Representative Hillstrom, and she and I have been working on this bill. We've been working in collaboration with MnCASA, which is the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault, and also Minnesota Coalition of Battered Women. We've been working with the University of Minnesota. We've been working with MNSCU and with the private colleges. And, of course, I've got the esteemed Joelle here from the student. She's a student body president for the U of M, and she represents several student groups. And so we've been trying to, no one is completely happy when you have so many parties at the table, but I believe that we've come up with a work product that is really, really good, and it will accomplish what we want to do. This bill is addressing the very difficult issue of sexual assault on college campuses. And it's a uniform policy for all of post-secondary institutions for both students and employees. It covers any incident that happens either in a building either owned or rented by an institution, and also any activity, program, or event sponsored by an institution, including fraternities and sororities. Again, this is a bipartisan effort. We have many co-authors on both sides of the aisle. It's a collaborative effort between the institutions, the advocates, and the students. And this bill covers many, many different areas. I'm going to briefly talk about them, and then I'd really like for you to hear from the testifiers. First and foremost, it expands victim rights. Second of all, it provides uniform amnesty. So if a student reports an incident, the institution cannot punish the victim who is in violation of a drug or alcohol policy during the assault if that student reports in good faith. There also needs to be a memorandum of understanding. So an institution has to enter into an agreement with their primary local law enforcement detailing the responsibilities of each, including investigation, communication, evidence preservation, and information sharing. And that memorandum needs to be looked at every 2 years. This also creates an online reporting option, which is incredibly important. I'm a mother of three children that are right now at St. Cloud State. And I know that those three are always on their smartphones. And so this gives them an online reporting option. They can do it from their smartphone device. It allows for anonymous reporting. So I consider that a little baby step if a woman has been assaulted, that they can report anonymously. And in so doing, they can also receive information from the institution about what would happen if they made a formal report. It also gives them options as far as different counseling and services that they can seek. There is also a data collection and reporting component of this to Office of Higher Ed, and there are many different things that we're asking institutions to report to the Office of Higher Ed. The very first and most important thing is the number of incidences defined by the Federal Clery Act. And so that makes it very, very clear. As many of you might know, that there is several reporting requirements in the Clery Federal Act. And so we don't want to overburden the institutions. And so the very first thing is if there is an incident as reported and defined in the Federal Clery Act. And it is very, very akin to our state law, and it would be the codes 1 through about 4.5. So it's slightly different, but it is close as we can come without overburdening the institutions. It also has what happens to that incident after. And so there's a whole long list of things that the institution has to report as to what they did with that incident report. And I'm going to have the testifiers go into some of that detail. There's also a requirement for comprehensive training. So the security officers, the administrators, and all those involved in directly responding to sexual assault would have comprehensive training, which is really important to me, coming from the mental health background that I do, that we really have trained and specifically in what it's like, what that victim is experiencing, and so that they treat that person with respect and dignity and proper care. So I'm really excited about that part of this component. The other thing is that each new or transferring student will need to complete a short course in the definition of what sexual assault is, what consent is, where to report if something happens, and a few other components. And so they only need to complete this one time, and then it appears on their transcript. So there's no confusion whether or not they complied with that or not. And then they can continue with their coursework. There's also a section about student health services. So if an institution has student health services on their campus, the sexual assault would become a part of the screening process. And so just like they would ask about chemical dependency or domestic violence, they would now ask about have they experienced any kind of a sexual assault. There also is a requirement to have a walk-in location that is trained with confidential advocates, again trained to know the different aspects of sexual assault and how to care for them best. This could be a health center, it could be a counseling center or other location. The important part is that they have a trained advocate there that can take care of them and kind of usher them through the process. So those are kind of the highlights, and I'd really like to turn it over to some of my testifiers to have them give you why this is incredibly important to them and what this bill does and how they've actually worked with me at great length. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Please identify yourself for the record and then proceed.
Yep. My name is Joelle Stangler. I'm the undergraduate student body president at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities. And I just want to thank everyone for being here today. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to testify on an issue that is of great importance and one that our campus has been doing a lot of work on, and I personally have been able to do a lot of work on. And so this is very much an honor and a privilege to be here today to talk about it. Also, I want to thank Representative O'Neill for the dedicated work that she's done. This is an issue that spans a variety of higher education institutions, and so it's difficult to find a bill that is able to provide accountability without being too burdensome, and then also to be able to balance the needs of a small school, a private school, and a large institution like the one that I come from. So we know that a lot of work has gone into it, and we're very satisfied with the results and look forward to continuing this conversation in the future. There are three things that I would like to touch on today in my support of the bill personally and on behalf of undergraduate at the University of Minnesota before I hand it over to our other testifiers who have some very personal stories to share with you. The first is that it really does support victims. It tells victims that we are extending the hand to them, that we believe them, that we trust them, and that we're willing to provide more services and support for them on their institutions. And so I think that that is a really, really crucial component to this bill. Additionally, the bill is also really important when it comes to accountability and making sure that institutions are doing all that they can to communicate with their law enforcement agencies as well as the people who will be hearing the cases on the panels through the training. And so we're very, very supportive of that aspect of the bill as well. And finally, we're also very supportive of the data component of the bill, which I think is perhaps one of the most complicated components of it, and that one that has had to go through lots of hoops in order to be within the confines of what the law will allow. But we think that this is a really important feature because of the huge complexity around the issue and the lack of understanding we have, that in order to effectively legislate and create campus policies and to support victims moving forward, we really do need to have this data collected now so we can get a better understanding of what the issue actually is. And so overall, we have broad support of this legislation. We thank Representative O'Neill for bringing it forward. And I would like to now hand over the mic to our testifiers who will tell you a little bit about their personal stories. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Welcome.
Hi, my name is Courtney Blake, and I am a student at the University of Minnesota, and I just want to thank you very much for allowing me to speak today. And thank you to Representative O'Neill, because this issue is very, very personal and important to me, and I am honored to have the opportunity to speak here. I am a two-time victim survivor on the University of Minnesota campus. I experienced two different sexual assaults within 1 year's time. My first case, I reported to the university, and they did not have the resources or the accountability to give my assailant more of a punishment than academic probation for 1 year. In my second case, I reported to the Minneapolis police, and I'm still battling this case as we speak today, even though this is 6 months ago. I fully support this bill with the idea that this is something that victim survivors on university campuses can feel safe, and that their university is taking steps forward to understanding what victim survivors are going through and to understand how severe and desperate we feel when something like this happens to us. It affects your student life completely. What I find most important in this bill actually was the uniform amnesty part, because right now, since I decided to report to one institution, I could not report to another. I could not go to the Minneapolis police as well as my university to seek sanctions for my perpetrator of this crime. I also found the component for online reporting to be very compelling and something that would have potentially changed my outcome. I did not report my first case until a week and a half after the incident because I was afraid of confirming what had happened to me, and I was afraid that it would be too hard to hear in person that this is actually, it was a case of sexual assault. So I think that having a victim survivor being able to report online and being able to admit to themselves that this might have happened, and what can my university do about it for me, and how can my university serve me as a student, could be very powerful in making very huge steps forward on this issue, because we've seen everywhere in the news that this has become, campus sexual assault has become a very dire issue, and I'm glad that it's getting the attention it deserves finally, and I'm hoping that the legislation will reflect that.
Thank you very much for being willing here to share your story with us. Welcome.
My name is William Dahman, and I'm a student at the University of Minnesota. At the University of Minnesota, I serve on the Interfraternity Council, which is the governing body for the fraternities on campus. My role is to be the campus safety coordinator. The most important things that we are working on is educating fraternity men on what consent actually is, when you can get consent, and how they can prevent sexual assaults from occurring. Gone are the days where we preach about being fraternity brothers, that is a gentleman, to our own members, and then turning around to instead be a frat bro that is worried about having sex and drinking alcohol. This is something that must and will stop. The Greek community has drawn scrutiny from all around, but I want you to know that we are doing our best to make the University of Minnesota campus as safe as possible. And I believe that Representative O'Neill's bill will continue to help us fight to prevent sexual assaults and support victims. I believe that supporting victims is one, if not the most important thing that we can do. Representative O'Neill's bill adds over 10 provisions to the victims' rights section of the law that may seem like common sense, but are issues that face victims every single day. I will end with a question that I want you all to answer to yourself. Are we fine with the status quo, or are we ready to take a stand against sexual violence? Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. Welcome. And
thank you.
State
good
your
afternoon.
Name, please.
My name is Jenna Landry, Mr. Chair, members of the board. Thank you for allowing me to testify today, and thank you, Representative O'Neill, for offering this bill. I'm a student at the University of Minnesota Twin Cities and also an organizer with Minnesota Public Interest Research Group. Lately, there has been a lot of very robust national discussion about sexual assault, especially on college campuses. And I support the HF 742 bill because I see it as a necessary reaction to this discussion. It would provide consistency and stability in how colleges across the state deal with sexual assault. I cannot tell you how many different variations of the same story I've heard from my fellow classmates and friends. Stories about how the trauma of their assaults only intensified when the legal system on campus failed to provide them with any sort of justice or closure from their assault or rape. I don't believe that this response from our legal system is due to apathy. Instead, it is in large part due to the lack of any sort of consistent framework dealing with cases of sexual assault. And this bill can remedy those inconsistencies. Rape culture deeply permeates our college campuses and our communities. Rape culture is a mindset that assumes violence will happen against its own citizens. It assumes young college students cannot control their own bodies. At night, my streets belong to monsters who, during the day, look just like me. Rape culture stamps vulnerability on my own body without my consent, and I refuse to feel vulnerable on my own campus. Eradicating sexual assault on college campuses is not a partisan issue. It's a public safety issue. A huge step towards eradicating a culture of violence that is so tightly intertwined with college life is to develop systematic solutions that ensure consistency and accountability in dealing with sexual assault cases. There's still more work to be done around standardizing definitions of consent, but this bill is a great first step. Thank you.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chairman, we will stand for questions, and I will field those if you or any members of the committee have them, but we understand that there are other testifiers today, so we are willing to stay until after committee to answer them in person, too.
Okay, we have one question. Representative
Gruenhagen?
Yeah. I recognize Representative Gruenhagen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
For a specific testifier?
I think for the author.
Okay.
And the students, I guess whoever would like to respond. But thank you for bringing this bill forward. I agree that it's a concern and needs to be addressed, and hopefully this will help in the process at a reasonable cost as much as possible. My question has to do with when students register for classes, are they given a brochure information such as, what if you're a victim? Here are things that you can do to avoid being a victim and what services are available. And another brochure, if you are found guilty as of committing the crime of sexual assault or violence, here are the consequences you can expect to happen to you as a student. In other words, it goes back to the idea an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure. And we know that a lot of a significant amount of sexual assaults happen at these drinking parties. So warning kids not to, especially girls, not to get overly intoxicated. I did 13 years of jail ministry before, and I used to have a Bible study with women and then with men twice a month. And inevitably, when you talk with the women, about some of this stuff, it's the use of illegal drugs and alcohol that puts them in a condition where they can be taken advantage of. And I think some type of warning in those areas, or one of the students mentioned education, would be helpful in the prevention area. So I don't know if something's being done already, or you're planning to do something, or what the status of that is.
Representative Neal, do you or any of the testifiers have a response?
I'll start, and then I think Joel probably has a response as well. So thank you, Representative Gruenhagen, for that question. And that is a component of this bill. That is something also that's happening sporadically across campuses now, that they have a training. Now, I don't know that they give out brochures anymore because I don't, these kids don't do brochures. I don't know if you know that, but they do.
I did.
Yeah. So it's an electronic brochure, but they have they'll be going through training online typically, but it's not exclusive to online. Some of the programs are actually face-to-face, and they will go through actually training, and there'll be some role-playing in some of the places. And so it's that part of it's a little bit open, but they need to talk about what is sexual assault and the definition, what is consent, and I appreciate your testimony specifically about the fraternities taking that seriously, because that's really where it starts as well, that there is a, you know, taking it seriously on both sides of that equation. You know, we have tried to ask, kind of answer that question within this bill as well and make it a uniform policy so that every institution does have to do a training, and they have to do it within the 10 days after they start class, because it's a little difficult when you talk about the U versus Minsky versus the privates and sort of how they accomplish all of this. But the intent is, yes, that they will absolutely have a training. Some of it will be online, some of it will be face-to-face, and they will be talking about those aspects as well. And I would say that they would have an online brochure, because it will be part of a website where they know where they can get services if something happens, and every institution will have that as well available to them.
Mm-hmm. I can speak on behalf of what I know about the University of Minnesota, and thank you, Representative Gruenhagen, for your question. Students are required to go through an online module training at the University of Minnesota upon entering. I believe it's called Haven, and it goes through definitions of consent. It goes through alcohol, as well as during orientation programming. There is a very interactive skit that they do that talks about a lot of the tough issues that college students face, and afterwards they do have a conversation about consent and sexual assault. So it is built into education and programming. I do think that there can be more to be done in terms of educating the severity of the punishment that comes about. I think that that might help in prevention as well. But I do think that there is a lot being done and continue to be done. But as of right now, I think the University of Minnesota is doing a really good job of being a leader on that.
Representative McDonald.
Thanks, Mr. Chair. Representative O'Neill, I just got a question regarding...
Can you grab a microphone there?
Thank you. Representative O'Neill, I'm just looking at your the amendment here and trying to follow through. What happens to your bill if it becomes law in relationship to the University of Minnesota's new policy of reporting of an assault? You know, they have a new policy. Ms. Whitney had, the news is now that you can't report certain criteria, you know, race, accent, tattoos, and I think two or three more. So how would that be, what happens to your law in relationship to the U and versus Minsky?
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Chair. So I thought you were going to ask a different question. So I thought you were going to ask about the Clery Act, which is the federal reporting requirements, but you're actually asking about the U's new provision where they'll kind of will remove race from that. So I believe that in most cases, not every single case, but in most cases when a sexual assault happens, that woman actually does know who the man is, and I don't know that a description is, I mean, you know, it's a different type of assault. It's not like someone's jumping out of the bushes typically and assaulting a woman, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, so while that might happen, I think that's incredibly rare. So I believe we're talking about assailants that are known to the woman. Mm-hmm. In the vast majority of cases. It would be quite rare to have someone stalking a campus and pulling a woman into a van or something. I think that's incredibly rare and on college campuses.
Mm-hmm. Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yeah. Representative McDonald.
Okay, thank you, Representative O'Neill. Then with that said, does your bill allow for that person then who was assaulted to describe the assailant? Race, creed, or color, tattoos, accents, even though if the University of Minnesota is against their policy.
We have a response, I believe, from this young man. Do you want to identify yourself again for the
record? William Dahman. I just want to point out that the new policy is in crime alerts that are sent out to University of Minnesota students. So a person is still able to report to police race, tattoos, that, but if there is not enough of a clear picture, the university won't send it out in a campus-wide email. So that was the new rule that was made.
And Mr. Chair.
That's a good clarification.
Mr. Chair, I believe we have a lobbyist from the U of M that may want to address that issue specifically.
Or he may not.
He moved from his spot, so I'm just
Okay. Okay. Welcome to
Mr.
the committee.
Mr. Chairman, yeah. Pat Iverson with the University of Minnesota, and I just want to clarify for the committee that descriptors will be based on a case-by-case basis when it is deemed by university officials to be beneficial to the community to know that, as well as in assistance of apprehending that particular assailant. So there's no steadfast rule that they will not be mentioned, but the rule will be judged on a case-by-case basis based on the facts of the case and where it would be deemed something that is informative and helpful in apprehending that particular assailant.
Thank you for the clarification, because the news media doesn't always make it that clear. So,
and Mr. Chair,
Representative O'Neill?
As far as my bill, I believe it's silent on that, but I would like to have a nonpartisan research comment on that if they could.
John? Mr. Williams?
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, there's nothing specifically in the bill that would address that specific issue. To the extent that the policy of the university deals mostly with emails sent out to students, I think that means that it sort of is even less addressed by the bill, I guess I would say. So most of the decisions to report particular details or make a report to the police is left up to the victim in the text of the bill.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, I do have a thank you, Mr. Chair. I do have a couple of testifiers I would like to hear from as well, from MNCASA, which is the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault, if we could, and then maybe continue with questions.
All right.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
They'd come down. Welcome to the committee. If you'd identify yourself for the record and then proceed, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Caroline Palmer, and I'm the Law and Policy Manager at the Minnesota Coalition Against Sexual Assault. I'm joined today by our Prevention Manager, Yvonne Knoyer, and she's going to help with answering any questions. MNCASA is a statewide organization. We represent over 60 sexual assault programs throughout Minnesota, and many of those programs either work directly with colleges and universities or might have a college or university in their community. I first want to say that we are very, very pleased to see so much interest in campus sexual assault, and we particularly appreciate Representative O'Neill's commitment to this issue. We thank her so much for working closely with us and other stakeholders on this issue to make the best possible law. It's very complex, as you can see from the length of the bill and a couple of things I'll bring up. We're dealing with state law, we're dealing with federal law, and just a lot of data collection issues. It goes on. So we are very, very pleased with the progress that the bill has made so far, and we look forward to continuing to work with Representative O'Neill on the bill. I also would like to acknowledge the strength of the survivor who came to testify here today. We appreciate hearing your voice, and I really want to thank all the students for taking time to participate in the process today and to speak out. Before I go on to bring a couple of suggestions to the committee, I just wanted to point out that MNCASA did provide a handout to you in your packets, and it just names out some guiding principles that we would like to see in campus sexual assault legislation. And I'm really happy to say that the bill you have before you today actually meets pretty much all of these principles on some level. So we're really pleased to see that, too. Our core concerns are around victim autonomy, access to advocacy, confidentiality, data practices protections, consistent practices across the board, and compatibility with federal and state law. And really important, of course, is meaningful training and prevention approaches, which were talked about earlier and we do believe are addressed in this bill. So I'm just going to talk briefly about a couple of issues we'd like to develop some more in the process. And really, again, these issues that I'm going to bring up really only speak to the complexity of the issue. It's not a deficiency in the bill. There's just a lot of things to cover here. So one thing I wanted to point out on line 3.22 of the bill is you'll see that the term forcible is present there. And that's understandable because that is taken from federal law. But also, when you read that part of the federal law, it goes on to make clear that a sexual assault doesn't have to be forcible. Coercion can come into play, or a victim can be incapacitated. And so we would appreciate it if maybe that term forcible could be removed from the bill language, only because we just don't want it to be limited. We want people to realize that there are lots of different ways that sexual assault can occur. And to back this up, actually, in recent years, the FBI changed its definition of uniform crime reporting to remove the word forcible, just so it was clear that there's a much broader range of things that can happen around sexual assault. It took them about 60 years to come to make that change, but they finally did a couple of years ago. The other piece I wanted to point out on lines 3.19 to 3.21 is there is discussion about access to campus files when a student complainant wants to see what happened in the investigation. And there is a law called the Federal Family Educational Rights and Privacy Act, and we've spent a lot of time talking about FERPA, as it's known, in this process. And there may be some additional discussions to have with us and with some of the colleges and universities about the interplay between FERPA and access to confidential files. But we're well on the way of having those conversations. Also on line 3.18, you'll see language about transferring and victims receiving information as they transfer schools. We would like to see language there just added that it would be at the request of the victim whether they receive that information. And really it's just so the student can have control on when and how they receive that information. And schools are not put in the position of having to track down transfer students and things like that. And then two other quick pieces, which was mentioned earlier about data collection. We're very thrilled about all the data collection that goes on in this particular bill, too. And there's a federal law called the Campus Accountability and Safety Act, and they enumerate even more areas of data collection. And we'd like to continue to have conversations about how we can align our state law with what federal legislation says, too. And again, that also kind of goes back to the conversation of making sure we're not having our schools, you know, double report or do more things than they're already having to do under the federal laws. And one more thing we just wanted to kind of throw out there for consideration is this bill does apply to students and employees. We would like there to be consideration of including visitors on a campus. If you think about the Penn State case, the young men who were on campus were visitors in a youth program, and we know that certainly a horrible sexual abuse case happened there. So we wanted to have further conversation about that. And then finally, some additional issues. We like the idea of online reporting, and we think that's a great addition to this bill. We would like to maybe see some information in the bill that helps colleges to understand that they need to report both anonymous and non-anonymous reports, just so they have a clear idea of how many reports they are actually getting, and that's something we could talk about further. But all in all, I just want to say that we are very pleased to see this bill moving forward. We thank again Representative O'Neill. She's been very open and collaborative in this process, and we look forward to continually working on it. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony. Do we have any questions of this testifier? Representative Grunhagen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a quick question. Are colleges required to publish the information publicly as far as how many sexual assaults they have on their campuses?
Representative O'Neill or
thank you, yeah, Palmer? Thank you, Chair. Representative Grunhagen, yes. And so with the exception of not, again, we had to balance federal law, but as long as they're not in violation of federal law, there's a certain aggregate number that they have to reach, you know, go over that threshold. But they will be reporting that to OHE, and then that will be public, yes. Office of Higher Ed.
Thank you. Seeing no other questions? Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Chair. Just a clarification between forcible and non-forcible. That's actually within the Clery Act, and so that's the reason that word is there is because it's very specific to a very specific part of the Clery Act, which is mostly aligned to our statutes level 1 through about 4.5, almost to 5. It's impossible to get our statute and the Clery Act to line up exactly, but when you look at the non-forcible part of the Clery Act, it talks about some things that would not be appropriate within this venue. I'll just leave it at that instead of getting into the detail of it. But It was considered.
Thank you. Do you have any other testifiers, Representative O'Neill?
I don't, unless there's public testimony that I'm not aware of.
Okay. We can open it up now to public testimony if there's anyone in the audience who would like to testify. I don't see anyone. Any closing comments, Representative O'Neill?
Thank you, Chair. I'm so honored to bring this forward. It's been a long road. We've got a little road left to go. I do want to acknowledge a few people in the room that work very, very hard, and we have both partisan and nonpartisan staff. Lauren Sweeney and Sean and Matt, both on our nonpartisan staff, worked incredibly hard at crafting this language, looking at federal law. This was a very complex bill to put together. I know we have a little ways to go. There's some components that we'll be continuing to talk about, but this is a great collaborative work, and I would appreciate your support moving forward.
Thank you. Representative O'Neill renews her motion to re-refer House File 742 as amended to the Public Safety and Crime Prevention Policy and Finance Committee. All those in favor of the motion, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails, and it's now referred to the Public Safety and Crime Prevention Policy and Finance Committee.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Well, we're switching bills here. Members might be interested in a news release that I received today. If I can have your attention for just a moment. This came from the Interfaculty Organization, from the Minnesota State College faculty, and from MinSCU and the MinSCU Board of Trustees. They have agreed to move forward cooperatively and collaboratively in the Secure the Future plan, affecting about 410,000 students. And this is the area where the governor had some issues, and I think that's all been resolved now. So I think we're glad about that. Representative Hamilton, good to see you.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. So I believe if I could get someone to move the bill.
Let's see if we can find somebody. Representative Isaacson will move the bill. House File 777. That's almost my phone number. I got 7777.
It's a lucky number, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, it's a lucky number. So Representative Isaacson.
I appreciate the compliment.
Yeah, kind of resemble him in a way. Anyway, so we have the bill before us, and it will be referred to the Government Operations and Elections Policy Committee at the end of the testimony. So would you like to begin, Representative Hamilton?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, committee members. I'm going to keep my testimony brief because we have some remarkable stories from some remarkable people. And basically what we're asking for is a grant, if you will, to be used towards spinal cord injury and traumatic brain injury. And the bill does lay out how those monies would be divided or allocated. Also have small business grants. It does set up a reporting structure and a council as well to help weigh in on how these dollars should be funded. And Mr. Chair, it was interesting. I had two individuals go past my office, and I let out a yell, and I said, "Come on in here." And so Rob and Billy was with you. They come into my office because I am shopping around for a wheelchair, and Billy's wheelchair was pretty cool, and I wanted to know, you know, what it was all about. And so they were telling me their story on why they're here. And you know what? It's pretty remarkable. Friends, this is what it's all about. You have a grassroots effort. You have individuals taking upon an issue on their own behalf and having the courage to share their stories and get, you know, a collaborative effort to come to St. Paul and, again, have the courage to share your story and bring forth an idea. This is what it's all about. So with that, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to turn it over to the testifiers, if I could, please.
Okay, who's going to be first in line?
I'll go, please.
Identify yourself for the record,
Mr.
and
Chairman,
proceed with your
testimony. My name is Walter Lowe. I'm a professor in the Department of Neurosurgery at the University of Minnesota. And I'm here today to testify in support of this particular initiative. So I've been at the university now for 25 years, and I've seen a lot of remarkable things that have transpired in terms of new therapies. Our department was involved in the first clinical trial for deep brain stimulation for Parkinson's disease, and we did some of the first patients in the country here at the university. And now that is a standard of care for many patients who no longer respond to medication therapy for Parkinson's disease. We are currently doing a clinical trial for a vaccine for treating patients with brain tumors, and where we take the peptides associated with the tumor antigen and then we inject those back into the patients to see if we can cure the brain tumors. And so in spite of all these remarkable advancements, I think that spinal cord injury and also traumatic brain injury has really lagged behind. Although there's some wonderful technologies that are available, I think that the impediment is the lack of funding. So if you look at the main source of funding right now at the National Institutes of Health, if you have 100 scientists submit a grant application, only 6 or 7 of those people will get a grant. The other 93 or 94 are left with trying to find other sources of funding. And these are people, these other 93 or 94 individuals may have an idea that may become the next Medtronic or the next St. Jude. So there is this gap here where we need funding in order to obtain pilot data that will allow us to then go to the National Institutes of Health to get a much larger grant. And so I think this particular bill will fit that gap. And I think it's an important initiative. I think it's important not only for the patients with spinal cord injury and also traumatic brain injury, but also it's a bill that will allow us to hire people, hire students, provide education for undergrads at the university, for them to learn new technologies, for them to become interns private industry and companies, and also to provide new products that may become startup companies. And so I think this is it's a wonderful opportunity. It's a wonderful bill for both the patients that have these disorders and for the state of Minnesota. So thank you for
Thank you for your testimony. And Representative Hamilton, who is next?
Want to go? Coffee John, brain injury survivor and traumatic brain injury support group founder and facilitator.
John, what was your last name?
John Sherrell.
Sherrell, okay, thank you.
Good afternoon, Chair and Committee. My name is Coffee John. I'm otherwise known as John William Sherrell. 24 years ago, I started one of the first coffee house art galleries in the Twin Cities. 21 years ago, I bought a HUD house in North Minneapolis, restored it, and made it my own home still today, returning it to the Minneapolis property tax rolls. 11 years ago, on April Fool's Day of 2004, I made a near-fatal mistake on my motorcycle, that of being in a hurry. I ended up in an accident where I sustained a traumatic brain injury. After 2 weeks in one of the nation's best ICUs, I graduated from Hennepin County Medical Center and was moved to Bethesda Hospital in St. Paul, where I started extensive rehabilitation. There, under the guidance of fine doctors and nurses, a staff an incredible staff, I learned to walk and talk all over again. What made this process daunting was that my body functions were being restored, yet my spirit still needed work. I returned home under much supervision and started outpatient coursework at the then called entitled Courage Center. Yet there remained the social stigma of having a slur in my voice. I was perceived as being drunk. I had a stagger. I drug my left foot slightly. My left arm was dead at my side due to a partial nerve separation. This added to the psychological complexity of the work that recreated the man who sits in front of you now. The mountains were high. The odds were long. And for 2.5 years, I tuned those walking and talking skills through physical therapy, occupational therapy, speech therapy, and the psychosocial important empowering coursework entitled Community Reintegration Program. I do realize I'm fortunate to live in the Twin Cities, where this kind of research, medical research, is ongoing and extensive. The level of human rehabilitation in this area is quite high. The brain, of course, is a very complex organ. Mankind is still learning on how it works. Nonetheless, understanding the dazzling ability to reroute social signal pathways in the effort to restore complex functions. Much more research is needed to discover how this incredible organ can run such a staggering number of cognitive computations, body functions, and articulated dynamic body movements. This kind of research requires manpower, resources, and money. More research should be done and can be done. Please look to fund this kind of research in that effort to improve all of mankind. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your very compelling testimony, and we would never have believed it if you hadn't told us.
A lot of hard work, sir.
Congratulations. Very good.
We do have another testifier, Mr. Chairman.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Rob Woodlick. I'm a spinal cord injury person, as you can see. It's been a pleasure to meet many of you and tell my story, too. This bill would improve the freedom, health, and longevity and quality of life of about 10,000 spinal cord people in Minnesota. Little note about veterans. I read this morning about 19% of veterans returning right now have traumatic brain injuries. It's pretty high. And in the veteran community, there's about 100,000 with spinal cord injuries or spinal diseases. Lifetime cost for somebody like me is around $5 million. I was injured at 26 years old. I need nurse, PCA care. I can't feed myself, stuff like that. And about 35% of people that have a spinal cord injury return to work. So a little bit about me before my injury. I was very outdoorsy. I just graduated with a degree in engineering. And I had a good job. I had a girlfriend. Well, that ended. But I'm a little afraid to ask out somebody on a date. Because you have to ask them to feed me. So, but. Anyways, yeah.
Sense of humor, too.
Yeah. So. The day I woke up, I kind of was not aware that I was going to end the day in the hospital. I was on the Grand Canyon on a river trip and dove in to get a bag of chips and some flat water. And they airlifted me with a helicopter to Las Vegas, and you do not want to go to the hospital there. I spent about 3 months on a ventilator, 4 months in the hospital between Vegas and Denver at Craig Hospital. I lost 60 pounds in 3 weeks, and I had to learn how to live with this injury. Afterwards, I mean, I can't scratch my face. You know, I have a lot of nerve pain, decreased sensation, but I can feel a lot in my body. You know, I have a catheter, ball, bladder, sex issues, risk of pressure sores, loss of time and productivity, and I currently do not hold a job. Yep. So I'd like to also thank Joe and other people here, too, for coming. Why we should have this here? We need this bill because spinal cord injuries are above the population of a special disease or orphan case. They're not high enough, though, to be lucratively investment kind of things, like diabetes and heart disease. So there is a return on profit, but it's not as much as like kind of a top investor would be interested in. So that's kind of why it's important for the government to step in to help aid this research. Couple other states that have similar programs. There's one in Kentucky where they have a spinal cord stimulator where they are shocking the spinal cord. People are standing up and moving, getting a lot of health benefits from it. Kentucky has a state program similar to what we're asking. So does California, and they've seen numerous biotech companies emerge from that program. And I mean, I'd like to thank you guys for this, for considering this bill. If this bill was passed years ago, we could have already had success stories in Minnesota, and I hope to return in 2 years to renew this bill and have good stories from it. So, thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr.
Members.
Chairman. We will stand for questions.
We have a question from Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Chair. It's really just more of a comment. I know that I had you all into my office and was we spent quite a bit of time talking because, as I shared with you, when I was 15 years old, I was thrown out of a vehicle and had a C2 fracture. Yeah, I shouldn't be here today. And that was long before they had a system like what Christopher Reeves was on with ventilators and so on. So I have a deep empathy for what you're going through. I've thought about it many, many, many times if it had actually severed the spinal cord, which was it was incredibly close. I don't think you could get any closer to what I experienced. And I think I'm about one out of a million actually suffer an injury like that and survive, especially back in 1985. It was a long time ago. So Representative Hamilton, I thank you for bringing this forward. And I think my brother might have a vested interest in this as well as he suffered from a brain tumor as well. And I know when the testimony about the limp and your arm kind of hanging and things like that, he was connecting because he still struggles. So I just, on behalf of myself and my family, and I don't know if my brother will speak, but I just want to personally thank you for bringing this forward. And this is certainly a need. And I know, as you shared with me as well, that you know if you could regain some of your function, you could feed yourself again, and you could do some things that would be beneficial. It'd be easier to get a job and things like that. So there is a true benefit in returning you to being more productive than you are now. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Pugh.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think I'll start with thanking Representative Hamilton for being such a champion for this important legislation. I'm just so, so pleased. And to all of the testifiers, I'm so grateful for your awesome testimony today. And to my constituent, Rob, you have been such an inspiration to me. We've known each other for some time, and I am so impressed with your tenacity, your work ethic. You know, I could go on, but not to mention your positive attitude. I just love it, and it's an inspiration to so many. And you know, I also want to thank those of your care providers. I know Rob's mom is here, and I've just been you know, really, really touched. I represent an area that covers almost all of the area around Lake Minnetonka, and I know of a number of people who have sustained spinal cord injuries while enjoying the lake, you know, very, very much, you know, like what you experienced. In fact, our son was enjoying, you know, boating right off of Big Island on Lake Minnetonka with some friends a couple of years ago. In fact, he was probably just about your age. And his friend took a dive and came up and was floating and was airlifted to North Memorial off of Lake Minnetonka, off of Big Island. And so I just, you know, this, and to Representative O'Neill's, you know, comments and how she shared her experience. You know, this is the kind of investment that we should be making as a state, looking for ways we, you know, members, we just, let's just do our very, very best to support those who clearly, you know, can't do this for themselves. You know, I feel like, I know, in fact, that, you know, we have like a perfect, it's perfect opportunity. I was going to call it a perfect storm, but a perfect opportunity to act on this. Here we have a world-class research institution like the University of Minnesota right here. We have the 3rd Congressional District, which I'm a member of the 3rd Congressional District, that is the epicenter in the world for medical device technology. And we have strong grassroots advocates like Rob and the others that we've met who are, you know, have issued us a call to action. So I think maybe enough said. I'm just so pleased. In fact, one other little thing, you know, I knew I would have an opportunity to welcome Rob into my office, and I was visualizing having a little bit bigger office this year, so I was, you know, looking forward to making room. And when I came here to the Capitol to move into my new office, somehow I got a smaller office, like a more narrow office. So I made the decision to let the desk go. I just have a small table, you know, on which I have my computer, and I have a table. So there's plenty of room for Rob to just wheel on in. And anyway, it was really, really fun to have you in my office, and I look forward to gaining the support of the Minnesota House for this important initiative. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Anyone in the audience wish to testify on this bill? I don't see any. Representative Hamilton, any final comments? You've had a very good presentation.
Your mom's going to make me cry again. Yeah.
Well,
give us some hope.
Yeah.
I might add.
Yes. John?
If you take breast cancer, I believe, MS, some other ailment, I can't remember the statistics. Sorry, my cognitive abilities are not what I wish to have. Add those all together times 6, and you still will not reach the level of traumatic brain injury or brain injury in general. This is ubiquitous. We know from the recent wars that there are an amazing amount of people coming home from serving who are dealing with a lot of issues. I understand that I'm one of the most fortunate brain injuries I have ever met. That's why I started my support group. That's why I am here. That's why I speak up.
And we appreciate that. Thank you very much, Mr. Sherrill. At this time, Representative Isaacson.
There you go. Renews my motion.
Thank you, Representative Isaacson.
Renews the motion that House File 777 be referred to Government Operations and Elections Policy Committee. And we need to vote on that. Let's vote on that. All those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Again, thank you for the presentation. This is very, very well done. We wish you well. Oh, been referred now to the Government Operations and Elections Committee. House File 777. Sounds like an airplane. Okay. With that, members, meeting is adjourned.